Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
What's next for Right to Work from APM? This is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. Welcome, everybody, to 12-12-12. We're going to look ahead after the big vote in Michigan. We'll talk about the economics of the North Korean missile launch. And we're going to talk with the author of Encyclopedia Paranoica, a big fat book of all the horrible threats under which we somehow continue to live our lives.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Michigan is the latest to pass a law turning itself into a so-called right-to-work state. That means employees in unionized workplaces can freely opt out of union membership and the union fees they would otherwise have had to continue to pay. For a look ahead at right-to-work in the U.S., I've got Harley Shaken, a labor economist at UC Berkeley. Hello.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So Michigan makes number 24, I think, almost half of states now with right-to-work laws. Where do you see the battle going from there?
Oh, I think we're going to see a battle nationally. I think more states might be emboldened by what took place in Michigan. But the battle isn't over in Michigan, and how that plays out could influence what happens to right-to-work in other states.
What's been the experience in other states that have become right-to-work states?
Well, it's often repeated that right-to-work attracts business, and I think there's very little evidence for that. What it does do in some states is it results in lower wages. That alone doesn't attract business. It has to be the productivity and quality. Really, in Michigan, and I suspect in future states, the political dimensions of this are front and center.
Right to work has become associated, of course, with the Republican Party. But beyond that, who is backing it? Is it businesses, companies that want this change?
Not necessarily. In Michigan, the business community has been very muted. The automakers have said they're neutral. The Detroit Chamber of Commerce hasn't endorsed it. I think this is being backed by people with a very strong political agenda that want to see unions weakened, particularly after this most recent election.
Does this episode in Michigan put some real fire, maybe some real fear, into the union movement?
I think it puts fire and fear into unions. Independents have been very alienated by this fast-track move in a lame-duck session to pass right to work. So losing independents on this, putting unions on the side of fair play, could prove very valuable, and it's certainly a wake-up call to unions, and it could prove damaging as well.
Labor economist Harley Shaken at Berkeley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now just a quick correction to this story as we covered it yesterday. In our conversation about the Michigan vote, we incorrectly referred to employment laws in non-right-to-work states. Here's how it works. In those states, employees cannot be required to be dues-paying union members. But if they refuse, they can be required to pay similar fees. It's the second and final day of the regular policy meeting at the Federal Reserve. Later today, we're going to hear what, if any, additional monetary stimulus the Fed board might endorse as the latest round of quantitative easing is set to expire. With me now, I've got John Sylvia. He's chief economist at Wells Fargo. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff.
John, what is your sort of best informed speculation, I guess, about what we might hear from the Fed this afternoon?
Well, the Fed knows that Operation Twist is ending in December, and the market's place is pretty much looking for him to do something with respect to extending some kind of easing. So our expectation is they're probably going to announce a program of buying Treasury securities and probably in the quantitative amount of about $30 billion, maybe $45 billion. The economy has improved, so there's probably a little bit less incentive for the Fed to do the entire $45 billion, but they'll do something there, and it probably will be buying Treasuries.
Some people have pointed out, you know, that the Fed has maybe done all they can with the housing market and other loan markets, but board members have voiced increasing concern for unemployment and sort of the broader economy. Is the Fed running out of power to affect things beyond housing?
Yeah, the housing market and auto market depend upon interest rates, and that's really the primary tool through which the Fed can influence the economy. Unemployment's very, very different. It's a whole ball of wax between, you know, laborers and workers and businesses hiring. It's a much more complicated area, and it's much more difficult, I think, for the Fed to influence that area. But they are looking at employment growth, and I think as long as employment growth is improving and the unemployment rate is coming down, they feel that they're achieving a little bit of help for the overall economy.
And just quickly here, we're a couple weeks out from the Black Friday shopping spree and all the excitement that came with that. What's your read on how the consumer's going to perform overall in this holiday retail season?
I think it's okay, but not great. I think a couple of things have really changed, Jeff. One, we've shifted away from just being Black Friday. There's a little more shopping on Thursday itself, and then also the following Monday. And then second of all, we've changed the way we shop, a lot more internet shopping than rather than just going directly to a retail store.
John Silvius, Chief Economist at Wells Fargo. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Well, it's been a quiet morning so far, so I don't want to hazard much of a guess as to what the day may bring. At this hour, a few hours into the trading day, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P are all more or less flat. Prices for both U.S. exports and U.S. imports fell last month. Those lower import prices are part of what's keeping U.S. inflation low. And applications for U.S. home mortgages rose more than 6% last week. That marks a new high point for the year. Home refinances are the lion's share of all those mortgages, about 84% of them. Refi growth had been slowing recently, but saw a pretty healthy rebound last week. The rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, by the way, is hovering at a historic low. Today, it's at 3.57%. So if you're still struggling for the perfect holiday gift for that person who has everything, ABC News has helpfully compiled a list for you of private islands that are currently on the market. There's Lyons Island, Ontario, just minutes from beautiful Sandbanks National Park. Hestholmen Island, featuring a waterside sauna and unique seclusion in the Swedish wilderness. Underwood Island in Connecticut, only 2.5 hours from NYC. Mind you, this is the affordable list of private islands. ABC only included those under $350,000.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
North Korea has successfully launched a rocket into orbit. The country says the rocket put a weather satellite into space, but there are concerns that the technology could help North Korea carry a nuclear warhead. There could be a UN Security Council meeting about the launch as soon as today. But what more can be done for a country that's already living under extensive economic sanctions? Earlier today, the BBC's Lucy Williamson talked from Seoul, South Korea, with my colleague Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
Well, it doesn't seem like any outside pressure is working here to stop North Korea from doing these tests.
That's right, and we can't say that the international community hasn't tried. There are already a range of sanctions on North Korea, and they haven't worked, particularly as we can see from this morning's launch. What's useful to note is that China, which was the one country that was seen to have some influence over Pyongyang, also is failing at the moment to have much influence over launches like this.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned China, because I was reading that China is still doing a lot of trade with North Korea.
That's right. China's in a unique position because it is really the only major ally that Pyongyang has. It's also a member of the Security Council, of course. So China has a responsibility to impose the sanctions that it itself passed in the Security Council. But it also does provide a lot of investment and aid to North Korea, particularly as the other supports for the regime have dripped away. So other avenues have dried up for North Korea, and China has become increasingly important.
Well, I'm sure that in the coming days, we're going to hear lawmakers here in the U.S. and around the world call for tightening the screws with these sanctions on North Korea. Is there anything more that could be done economically to try to stop North Korea from going forward with things like this?
It's very difficult. What we believe the Security Council will be considering is whether to expand the sanctions, for example, on specific companies, specific people in North Korea. But individual countries like the United States, for example, already have much wider sanctions on North Korea than the Security Council can get past. And then, of course, you have to impose them. We have been hearing reports here in Korea that China has become far more active in cracking down on some of the trade routes that North Korea uses through Chinese territory. But by and large, what the Security Council has in front of it at the moment is pretty much what it's had in front of it before.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The low-wage service industry is the fastest-growing segment of the U.S. labor market. But growing so fast can mean growing pains. Just in the last month, workers at a number of national retail chains have walked off the job demanding higher pay. Yesterday, we looked at what a raise of even a few bucks an hour can mean to a person. Today, a look at how that raise ripples across the economy. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
This story starts with a guy named Jonathan.
My name is Jonathan Smith.
Who worked at a movie theater chain where he made just above minimum wage, $7.75 an hour, lived in a cramped apartment with roommates, rarely had enough money for gas, so he didn't go out much.
It was tough scraping by. I was kind of just stuck in my apartment.
But say Jonathan's employer, the movie theater chain, had given him a raise to what economists call a living wage.
A wage sufficient for a family to be able to make their ends meet, to just cover the basics.
That's Amy Glassmeyer, a professor at MIT who created a living wage calculator for different parts of the country, the bare minimum you'd need to pay rent,
health care,
basic groceries,
transportation.
Nothing fancy. In a big city, the living wage for a single person's about $12 an hour, about $4 more than Jonathan Smith was making at the movie theater. Of course, that extra money would have been nice for Jonathan, but the money doesn't just grow on trees, says Bob Polin, an economist at University of Massachusetts.
Yes, the money does have to come from somewhere.
And the most likely place for that money to come from?
Price increases. Essentially, what we're talking about with a price increase is a transfer of money to the low-wage workers from people who are the consumers.
Worst-case scenario, those consumers stop spending money at that business because prices get too high and workers get laid off. Best-case scenario, the business makes more money because workers are happier and more productive. And don't forget, those workers are consumers, too, now with more money to spend. And that brings us back to Jonathan Smith, the guy who worked at the movie theater chain. It never did raise his pay. Eventually, he quit and got a job at Trader Joe's, which prides itself on offering a living wage. One of the first things Jonathan did when he got his new paycheck?
I'm a big cinephile, so I started going to the Arclight.
That's a movie theater in L.A. Once he made more money, he could spend it at the kind of place where he used to work. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Tonight at Madison Square Garden in New York, the boss, Bruce Springsteen, headlines a benefit concert for Superstorm Sandy relief. It's broadcast worldwide and streamed online. As Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff reports, this one could raise the bar for fundraisers.
After 9/11, there was the concert for New York. Today, Superstorm Sandy gets 12-12-12, a benefit with everyone from Kanye West to Billy Joel.
We hope we raise a lot of money.
David Saltzman is the executive director of the Robin Hood Foundation, which will dole out the proceeds to relief organizations. Before it's even begun, the concert has raised over $30 million. Saltzman thinks 12-12-12 could raise more money than the post-9/11 concert, thanks to technology.
They'll also be able to donate online in a way that they simply could not in 2001.
Gary Bongiovanni of trade publication Pollstar says 12-12-12 organizers are savvy at maximizing tonight's impact.
Adding in the streaming and social media aspects to the 12-12 concert is going to set a whole new standard.
Both Bongiovanni and Saltzman think the public could use a reminder of how much post-Sandy cleanup remains. It doesn't hurt if that reminder includes the Rolling Stones. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
You know, it seems like every time you turn on the news, there is some new danger to our health or to our financial well-being. With every new innovation to improve our lives, we get new fears. Think about Facebook privacy concerns or high-speed stock trading. Well, a couple of humor writers set out to catalog these threats all around us. They're both from the team that originally founded National Lampoon magazine, but the book itself is carefully researched nonfiction. It's called Encyclopedia Paranoica, and author Christopher Cerf is here to scare some sense into us, I guess. Hello, Chris.
Great to be here, Jeff. Thanks.
It would be nice if you could offer some easy guidance on how to live a safer life. But I gather with a lot of this stuff, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, right?
That's unfortunately the truth. For example, we've always believed that carrots are good for your eyes. But recently, the Australian Macular Degeneration Society has discovered that carrots actually cause macular degeneration, and they suggest that if you want to get the lutein that's supposed to be good for you in carrots, you should eat spinach instead. But unfortunately, spinach is bad for you too because it has oxalic acid in it that leaches the calcium right out of your bones. So you can't eat that either.
We're a business show, so let's talk business here for a minute. Do you ever get the sense that there is kind of a thriving business of fear out there that's making hay off of all of this stuff that you've filled a book with?
Yes, I think when people say everything's going to be great, it doesn't make for very good radio or reading or television. But beyond that, fear-mongering seems to be the main way that people try to either sell something or to advance their own agenda. For example, there's a doctor named Gerba out at the University of Arizona who tells you that something else will kill you because of the germs that are on it. But Clorox is actually paying for a lot of his experiments. So I don't know if that should lead us to believe that his advice about using more bleach should be followed or not.
So how do you live your life? Afraid of everything or afraid of nothing?
We recommend omniphobia, fear of everything, but perhaps you could take another point of view and just try to ignore all this. Of course, it's hard because in this holiday season, we're going to be surrounded by horrible things like mistletoe is poisonous. You might not know that. Mm. Holly berries are poisonous. Poinsettia is poisonous, too. And, of course, mall Santas get coughed on by kids, so they spread diseases. And Santa is so fat that he's a terrible role model for kids. And the Surgeon General a few years ago recommended that Santa be portrayed as skinny and fit to be a better role model.
Danger around every corner. That's the spirit of the season. Christopher Cerf is one of the authors of Encyclopedia Paranoica. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeff.
And wrapping things up here, you're probably not familiar with Little Newberry College in South Carolina, but today they're getting a little bit of attention for rolling out what seems to be the country's first undergraduate major in social media. Talking to a local Fox affiliate, a professor describes this as a blended major of graphic design, communications, marketing, psychology, and statistics. And probably involves a lot of playing around with Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and whatever else comes along, which sounds kind of frivolous, but companies need young people who know their way around this stuff. According to one local employer near the school, if there are students coming out with a degree in this, she says, I've got a job for them. Here at Marketplace, we are already experts, I tell you, at social media. For example, every day we are Twittering our twits on the Twitter at Marketplace APM. Well, that's all for the 12-12-12 edition of the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.